Hi, I'm Kim Bussey-Chamberlain, a paramedic, mum and author. As paramedics, we're often asked, what's the worst thing you've ever seen? And I'm here to encourage a different kind of conversation, to uncover what it takes to work in these frontline roles and the privilege we experience in meeting and connecting with patients. This podcast is all about what it's really like to be a paramedic or any frontline uniform professional. Each week, you get to hear from the real humans under the uniform, the memorable moments they've experienced in their jobs, and the people that have stayed with them for life. Let's hear what life is really like beneath the blue lights. Welcome to Beneath the Blue Lights, the paramedic podcast. I'm Kim, your host for this series. Today, I'm joined by the completely brilliant Richard Webb Stevens, or as he's known to those in the ambulance service, RWS. RWS can only be described as something of a legend in the service. He's a fantastic paramedic with so much experience, ranging from motorcycle response unit to a flight paramedic with HEMS. His knowledge is vast, but he's also a man of many talents. His social media accounts are testament to this. They regularly feature beautiful photos he's taken capturing our capital city and the people in it, sometimes from the sky, clips of him playing music, and photos of his many mouth-watering RWS appies. He's also been an inspiration, talking about his experience as a deaf paramedic. But above all, RWS is known for being one of the friendliest faces you can bump into. Always kind, always compassionate, and always willing to have a chat and share his time and knowledge. Hi RWS, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, Kim. That's such a lovely accolade to listen to, and probably not deserved, but yeah, much appreciated indeed. Thank you.
Very much deserved. And like I said, it's so nice to have you on, and I'm really glad that we're getting this opportunity to have a chat. It's going to be a good one, I hope.
Thank you.
So first of all, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of how you decided to become a paramedic, how long you've been doing the job for, and what you do now.
Indeed. Okay. So to roll back to 1974, if I may, when I was born. So I was born in 1974, back in quite a few decades ago. And about 4 years later, they found out I was severe to profoundly deaf due to sensory neuro hearing loss in both ears. Now, one ear was hearing loss induced by a traumatic birth delivery. So the umbilical cord wrapped around my neck, and that resulted in oxygen starvation, which caused hearing loss in one ear. And the other ear was caused by genetical hearing loss. So for audiologists that are out there and that deal with me, they become fascinated by this because you've got two distinct different types of hearing loss, albeit both sensory neuro. So like I said, born in 1974, grew up in the 70s and 80s in a very small village in Chipperfield, Hertfordshire. And I went to mainstream school, which is where they ascertained I had the hearing loss. I had elocution lessons initially by an Australian lady and then an Indian lady. And so I developed accents of both kinds of throughout my years. Then when I went to secondary school, I rebelled quite a bit because wearing hearing aids in a mainstream school where everyone's got short hair was an issue. I was trying to grow my hair out long so it covers the hearing aids. But by this time, this was like the mid, late 80s, and long hair was not a thing. So I tried to fit in. And as a result of that, I suffered. Well, I didn't suffer. I certainly didn't prosper as well as I should have done, because I've had the hearing aids, the right communication, I could have done a lot better in my exams and education. And then my ultimate goal then was to join the armed forces, but my grandparents did, my great grandparents did, my great uncles, etc. And I was in the air cadets. I loved the sort of lifestyle, the thought of having a career in military services. And at the end of the day, I knew my hearing would stop me from doing so. But me being me, I can never accept no unless the whole world tells me no.
And even
and
then.
Everything else. Exactly. And even then. So at the age of 16, I went to the Army Careers Office. I passed all the exams for any trade I wanted, with a commission, without a commission, whatever I wanted. And they said, right, brilliant, no problem. Next step, son, medical. The first step of the medical is the hearing test. So you go into the booth, and it's the booth I've been to 1,000 times since the age of 4, where it's a soundproof room. you hold a little button which you press down every time you hear a beep. And there's a window to the side. And I remember going up there, sitting in, the sergeant's on the outside. He said, right, okay, son, off you go. Now I'm sitting there waiting, think, when's it going to start? And eventually this head appears in the window. And he goes, hello, son, we started about 2 minutes ago. Oh, okay. And anyway, I pressed the buttons as much as I could when I could hear the sounds. And he was very kind. And he said, look, if you don't realise already you've got a hearing problem, then I seriously suggest you go and see a GP and get yourself checked out. And I said, okay, fair cop, you got me. Anyway, that didn't stop me. So I went to the Navy and the Royal Marines, different headquarters, and the RAF also. Exactly the same thing happened. I passed all the assessments. I went for the medical, first step with the hearing test. They all said the same thing. But for me, at least I could accept I couldn't do that job at that time. And I was looking around for a profession I wanted to do at the end of my A-levels, and I saw nursing. So I enlisted in a course for a RGN course, which is Registered General Nursing Course. And this was precursor to the diplomas and degrees. And this is back in about August 92. And so I went to Charing Cross Hospital, and I was doing a course there for 3 years as a registered general nurse, which would, in nowadays context, enable me to be a fully qualified nurse in general nursing for adult care. But while I was there, I met my wife, my wife now. However, I got quite significantly sidetracked and spent a lot of the time courting her and probably not focusing on my studies. But also, more importantly, I did not wear my hearing aids. So through secondary school, with the rebellious type of not wearing the hearing aids, wanting to fit in, going to further education and work and not wearing my hearing aids, at that time was a massive deficit for me. And I have no doubt, had I worn my hearing aids through school, had I worn them through nursing college, I would be me as I am now, but in a different qualification, different skill set. And so that's something I have to live with. And certainly something I really push out now to people that wear hearing aids, how important it is to do so. It is hard, it's difficult, because sounds don't sound natural. Sounds are painful. Wearing a hearing aid for say a 14-hour shift, if you're doing 12 hours on duty, 2 hours either side, waking up, traveling, etc., it's the equivalent of, say, the average person with perfect hearing wearing a an iPod with their headphones plugged in at 100% volume for 14 hours, plus trying to hear the conversation of people coming through. So you've got this wall of noise. Now, the way I differentiate it is, as a hearing person, you catch stuff all the time. You're like an athlete. Someone throws a ball or throws a sound, you catch it. Whereas myself and other deaf people, when you listen, listening is different to hearing. So hearing is catching. Listening is searching for that ball, or being like an eagle. Or in my case, it's being like someone on a cricket field or baseball field who's constantly running around, zigzag, 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 everywhere, trying to find that ball on the hope of catching it, retaining the information and getting that information correct. But nonetheless, I met my wife, I got sidetracked, and so I didn't study too hard. However, in my A&E department placement in ED at Charing Cross, I saw the paramedics coming in and out. And that's the first time I saw paramedics in the ambulance service. And that would have been February 1993. So I saw them and I thought, well, this is slightly similar to nursing. However, you've got the benefits of not spending a 12-hour shift with the same patient, not spending a 12-hour shift with a team of people who you're under, and you're outside. And I'm very much an outside person, and I'm very much an autonomous person. And so when my nursing career came to an end, basically due to failing the exams, I sought a career in the ambulance service, which took about 4 years to get into, because at that time they weren't recruiting. And then eventually in 1998, I passed my exam for the ambulance service. And then I joined in 1998, November 15th, and started my technician course. Oh. And then the rest followed from there.
Wow. That's an amazing story. It's so interesting to hear. And and I think also just knowing everything that you've achieved in this role, in this profession now, to think that it wasn't kind of your initial first destination, is quite incredible to see that progression and things as well. I wanted to talk a little bit about this question that paramedics often get asked. That's a real pet peeve question. It's one that most of us hate hearing. Whenever you tell someone, oh, I'm a paramedic, and they say, wow, what's the worst job? What's the worst thing you've ever seen? So I wanted to know whether you've been asked this question and how do you handle it?
Okay. It's a common sort of meet someone at the bar, at dining table, at dinner party, et cetera, et cetera. You mentioned trade and they expect Armageddon. And to be honest, in 23 years service now, next month, I really have seen, I believe, pretty much everything you can see. However, you never, ever take it for granted you've seen everything because you always learn something new. But whether it's a catastrophic event from a major trauma and then or a medical loss from paediatrics to elderly care, it's so difficult to differentiate between what is worse. But I think I suppose the worst you can ever see is basically inhumanity, really. It's the cruelty that humans can inflict upon each other for, they're not reasons, they're excuses, really. I mean, a reason to inflict cruelty on someone else is to defend yourself, but it's not cruelty, that's protecting yourself. It's the fact that people use excuses, whether it's race, religion, sexual orientation, anything else in between, inequality, for an excuse to commit horrible things on other people. And that becomes extremely distressing. But I think the more you do as a paramedic, the more skills you develop, the more experience you develop, for myself, through being a motorcycle paramedic through to HEMS, the more you can deliver to that patient, it's not the less the feeling you get, but it's more the fact that you can deal with that situation. So if you're a junior paramedic turning up to a very bad trauma call, where the only thing that patient needs is an anaesthetic, or a surgical intervention, a very rapid deployment to ED, it's very difficult to deal with. So if I turned up now on a motorcycle, even as a HEMS paramedic or ex-HEMS paramedic, if I turned up now to those same patients, there's only so much I can do. However, what I can bring is scene management, reassurance. I can see the bigger picture, and it's not about taking shortcuts. It's understanding the journey this patient needs to take to get to the hospital, and then me sort of getting the group around to facilitate that quickly. However, if I turned up a year and a half ago on the aircraft with the doctor, and we can anaesthetize, we can do operations, etc., all of a sudden, that humanity you bring is immense, because you can bring huge pain relief for humanitarian reasons or for energy reasons. You can anaesthetize people, you can carry out a lot of procedures on scene. So it eliminates that frustration of turning up with a bottle of Entonox, some morphine or some paracetamol, which is not going to touch an angulated fractured femur, open pelvis, etc., etc. So in those senses, having those extra skills, working with a team that can deliver those skills can alleviate those fears.
Yeah, for sure. So in terms of conversations that you like having with strangers, and so when you meet someone out and about, like you said, dinner parties, restaurants, wherever it is, what are the conversations that you enjoy having with other people about the job and about what your role kind of involves?
Okay, mostly it's the humanity side of it. So I think the world is influenced hugely by the media, you know, whether it's these people are bad, those people are bad, there's war everywhere, this is horrendous, etc., etc., etc. All we see every day is what is interesting in the media, because the media per se have to exist to entertain people, whether it's the news and this whole thing with breaking news. You know, you wake up, it's 7 o'clock, breaking news, this has happened. And then for about 3 hours, you get breaking news, but nothing much has happened. A building's caught fire, and you get to the end of the story. No one's burnt, a few flats are burnt out, and everything's good. But you've got 3 hours of constant accolade, and then that builds up to social media, to Twitter, and other things that are sort of building up. Yet in reality, when you go to an RTC on Oxford Street, the Old Kent Road, Kenton Lane, etc., you have an incident where you got 20 people, or you have two people. And in the news, you'll be told that this person, because of their religion or their orientation, doesn't agree or get along with that person. Whereas in our job, we'll turn up, we'll deal with human beings. And you'll have someone who's on the floor who could be, I don't know, a Muslim lady wearing the hijab. And then a Jewish person turns up, a gay person turns up, or anyone else turns up, and they look after their brother, their sister, their stranger as a matter of humanity. And I don't think that is portrayed enough in the news, in reality, etc. Because why would it? It's not interesting. It's what people have been doing for thousands of years without the influence of whether it's right-wing groups or the media, etc. So for me, it's the fact that you can go to someone totally random, you know, an elderly person looking after what other people might perceive as a thug because they look like a thug and they're not, or they might look like a gang member, but they're probably not. And it's the fact that they can have that basic humanity to look after someone, not just call an ambulance because they're on a bus going past the street and a patient down the road, but the people that stop, the people that help. And then when you turn up, you get the back history. And that, for me, is the reassuring thing, that amongst all this, all the bad stories we hear in the media and social media, there are a greater good of people that will look out for one another in their time of need.
Yeah, so it's basically like flipping that conversation a little bit, with people sort of assuming that our jobs are all about seeing the worst that you can see and seeing the worst of mankind, to flipping the conversation to the privilege that we have in our jobs of being able to see all the best of people as well. And that's something that maybe we don't get to talk about as much.
Absolutely.
But that for us is really, it keeps us going really in the job as well.
It is, it is. I mean, indeed, as in a profession where you're perceived as lifesavers, you're perceived as people that jump in the deep end, it's all trauma because of whatever, TV casualty, Holby, etc., and which is exciting, but it's not reality. I mean, it's much like being, I suppose, in the armed forces, where 99% of the time you're drilling, you're training, you're going to the mundane jobs, and then 1% or 0.1% of the time it is trauma, cardiac arrest, etc. But it is the reality of life, that people do want to help people. People do want to do the right thing. People do want to be kind. And it's interesting now that the theme, the topic, is to be kind to people. And I think in reality, 9 times out of 10, the world has done that over and over and over again. And yes, there have been horrible episodes of historical events, whether it's war or genocide, but in a peacetime event, 9 times out of 10, people do act on the right instinct of looking after their stranger. And that's not publicised enough. But in reality, the strangers that do stop to call 999, the strangers that do stop to stay and help people are the reality of our job.
Yeah, because
absolutely. That's what makes our job real.
Absolutely. And it's really heartwarming as well when you come across those people where, you know, often they will stay with that person. They don't know them at all, but they've given them so much comfort in that person's time of need. And then they continue to do that, sometimes traveling with us in the ambulance even. I've had that happen before as well. And it does kind of restore your faith in humanity, I guess. I guess on the same sort of theme, do you have any particular memories that have stuck with you from your job over these years, whether they're funny situations you found yourself in, ridiculous ones, or heartwarming things that will stick with you forever about patients you've come across or situations you've found yourself in?
Ooh, I think it's difficult to remember individual ones because certainly with 23 years, there's an awful lot of brain picking to do. But it is those occasions, they are those occasions where you turn up on a random scene, whether it's a quiet suburban night, or whether it's a busy West End High Street, where you have got strangers, you have got people that doesn't matter if whether it's their class, race, or status, whatever, they're stopping to help their fellow human being, and they're doing the right thing. And it's just the fact that we don't see it enough publicised in the news, if that makes sense. Everything's always doom and gloom. But yeah, it's a difficult one to answer with specifics, but it's just the fact that I think overall, when it does get bad, when there is a crisis, you get the people that sort of stand back, but most of the people go forward just to help, whether it's a phone call, whether it's to mm-hmm. call us to or to hold someone's hand. But yeah, trying to think of a specific, I'm afraid, would be quite difficult.
That's okay. The other thing I wanted to touch on is obviously at the moment we found ourselves in a very unique time working through a global pandemic. And particularly for paramedics who are often in high pressure or stressful situations at the best of times, it's been ramped up massively during this period. What do you think is a good way to kind of maintain good mental health? And what does that mean to you in the job? How can paramedics and other frontline medical professionals achieve that for themselves?
Okay, so this I find really interesting. So throughout COVID, I have almost seen a role reversal from my own situation. So myself being born deaf, struggling with communication, struggling with face masks, struggling with loud noises. All of a sudden, watching all my peers in a situation where everyone is wearing a face mask, and at the same time, they're going to elevated calls because we've had COVID 1, 2 and 3, where we're going to either constant cardiac arrest, and in code 2, where it's young people having cardiac arrest for no apparent reason other than COVID. And you've got the D mask, you've got the FFP3, IAR mask, all the variations in between. And I'm looking around and thinking, wow, all these people, I walk into a cardiac arrest now and everyone's wearing a mask.
Yeah.
And for some reason, it's almost like I'm the only person not struggling. Mm. So it's a bit like when I discussed before about people hearing and catching. So I'm walking in now, most likely as a different role because I'm a clinical team manager. But even so, when I walked in as a motorcycle response paramedic or HEMS paramedic 2 years ago, it's very much the same because you turn up, there is that expectation that you're going to not take the lead per se, but you'll certainly be a source of questions and hopefully answers. But I'm walking into these situations where you go to a cardiac arrest now, everyone's wearing a mask, a D mask or IAR mask, and nobody can hear each other because they're all maxed out, and they're going to situations where it's high intensity, it's cardiac arrest, and on top of that you've got to wear a suit where no one can see who everyone is. They can't work out their paramedic, an EEC, a technician, a CTM, an IRO, etc. Everyone's wearing masks, and very often you've got people from different parts of the service turning up for the same call. And so you don't know them by local nature, so you can't ascertain. And then you can watch from my point of view, and people are going, they're talking to each other. And they'll go, well, what time was the last adrenaline? And the person will go, pardon, I didn't hear that. And then they'll look at them, what time was the last adrenaline? And they go, I can't hear that. And I'll say, what time was the last adrenaline? So for me, with hearing loss, when it comes to lip reading, there's this big fallacy about FBI and the CIA and the NPS and NCA, etc., having these forensic lip readers. Now, they do exist, but they only exist out of historical evidence. They watch a videotape or someone, and they have to ascertain what's happened, what's been said. Now, the thing with lip reading, only 30% of any conversation can be lip read.
Wow.
Because simply spoken, is the lip patterns of many, many words are identical. Now, there's a classic joke in the deaf world of elephant shoes or pineapple juice or I love you. Those three phrases, if you do them with lip reading, look identical because of the lip pattern created during the words. So people that do 100% lip reading, they have to establish a context of the conversation. So at home, if I'm talking to my wife without the hearing aids, we establish a conversation, whether it's baking, her friend, my friend, cooking, whatever, you establish the conversation. And thereafter, I will sort of basically grab at words in the ether that make sense of that conversation. Much like you do if you're hearing and you're talking to a stroke patient with dysphasia, and they're trying to speak, and they start speaking, they go, oh, and yeah, on Saturday, I've got this chest pain. And then 9 times out of 10 as a clinician, you can add the words for them because you suddenly think, okay, stroke, Saturday, chest pain, whatever, and you're grabbing those words. And lip reading is much the same. So unless you establish a context, it's very difficult. You put a mask in front of it under mouth, it is horrendous for myself. What's really interesting is walking into situations now, cardiac arrests, where everyone's wearing a mask, and I'm the only person that can really understand what's going on, because I've got that ability to stand back, but also I don't hear, I listen. So if I listen to a rhythm pattern, what time was the last adrenaline? And they go, yeah, 21:42, brilliant, 21:42. And then you sort of grab at those sort of words. And it's really interesting seeing that whole change in communication, because as much as deaf people lip read, we can't lip read everything. We can lip read a percentage, and then whatever you can't lip read, you hopefully can hear with your hearing aids. But looking at hearing people now in a situation, you realise everyone uses facial recognition for emotions, understanding. I mean, people could be quite blunt and swear at someone in a conversation in the pub and go with your mate and go, oh, F off, so-and-so, blah, 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 blah. And it'd be quite funny because that'd be between two mates within a context and you understand it. You know, you're with the best mate in the pub and they'll say, oh, yeah, I did so-and-so the other day. If they turn around and say, oh, F off, blah, 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 it's funny. But if you put a mask in front of that same person, that same conversation between two best friends or a couple, and those same words come out, all of a sudden, someone's thinking, I don't understand that. Why are they swearing at me? They're not swearing at you. They're swearing in the context of that conversation. And very much so in the cardiac arrest situation or trauma situation, where everyone's wearing a mask, everyone's eyes in, they're relying on the fact that for years they've heard everything, but now they have to listen, which takes a lot more effort because you've got to see and you haven't got any of the facial recognition because of the mask, which is where the clear mask or the clear hoods really come into their own. Because there's some interesting stories at the beginning of COVID I was seeing where they had experienced trauma crews, medical crews in different hospitals around London doing exercises, and they were maxed out. These are people that have been consultants, nurses, experienced paramedics for years and years and years that now could not communicate the same situation as they would 3 months ago with no mask, with no PPE. So the fact that you've got communication barriers for hearing people now, I find fascinating, because that is reality of the world for one in seven of us that are deaf. But also it's probably the barrier for most of the miscommunications, misunderstandings, and prejudices we expose ourselves or experience ourselves in our world because of not understanding each other, because of lack of communication.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting point of view to hear, actually. And I think it's obviously we've heard a lot. There's been quite a lot put out about deaf people in the pandemic struggling with things like masks and asking for innovations to help with that, whereas where those kind of plastic see-through masks and things came out. But to hear it from the other side actually is really interesting and not something I had heard, but can very much see exactly what you mean. Yeah. So another question I have for you was about your hobbies. I touched on them in the intro. You're a busy man. you're always up to something and you have many skills. So is that something that helps give you balance with the job and then what you do in your downtime?
Indeed, yeah. I mean, my main passions, well, now are cooking, which goes along with eating, and music. So ironically, I grew up in a very musical family. So my grandfather played piano, accordion, organ. My mum played piano and wind instruments. And my father was a guitarist. And yet I did not pick up an instrument till I was 16 years old, much to my shame. I think it's good because they didn't push me into a direction I didn't want to go. But all of a sudden at 16, I watched the Blues Brothers and I suddenly decided I want to play the guitar. So I asked my old man, how do I play this? And he taught me how to play the 12-bar blues. So three chord trick, E, A, B, 7, off you go. And I played Sweet Home Chicago. I fell in love with Santana and Jimi Hendrix and Gloria Estefan, and basically emulated their music all the way throughout. So whether it's jazz, rock, sort of Latino, etc. So my release is playing music, learning music, but I can't leave music. Albeit being severe to profoundly deaf in both ears, I play by ear. So you listen to a tune, and much like most things in life, and indeed medicine, music is very much a set of patterns. So you get a chord sequence that goes a certain way, and you get a gist of it. You look at people playing their chords. Oh, that's an interesting way of doing stuff. And I basically look, copy, listen, copy, and then do the best I can. So where my dad, he was a Hank Marvin fan, so the Shadows, everything was for him note perfect. I'm more Santana, Jimi Hendrix, the blues. So a few bum notes is not a bad thing. It's all part of the melody. But yeah, so I basically listen to music. My wife is a very talented singer and organ player. So she's got a church background. So she plays and sings in church. And for years, she'd be doing that. I'd be doing my gigs. And then a few years ago, quite a few years ago, actually, well, funny enough, when I applied for HEMS, I was given 4 weeks' notice from my application form to, right, you got a assessment date in 4 weeks' time. And then the day after, I got a notification from a mate who tried to organise a gig at the stage door in Waterloo. And we were going to headline a gig, me and Marie, and have a bunch of people turn up for an open night. And so for 4 weeks, I had to rehearse for HEMS. So go through JR Calc, go through all my scenarios. Mm-hmm. And I also had to learn 12 new songs with my wife and with our first big gig. And I turned up for my HEMS assessment with my guitar on my back, massive suitcase full of my guitar pedals, my change of clothes. And Graham Chalk, who was the governor there, he goes, oh, what are you up to then? And I said, well, I've got a gig after this. He goes, you are kidding, right? And I said, no. He goes, this is your HEMS assessment. I said, yeah, I know. And I said, bad timing. So anyway, I did the HEMS assessment, which was mental, and luckily succeeded. But I remember coming out of it quite shell-shocked, going to the pub with all the other candidates and good dear friend Susanna Tro at the time. And we all sat in this bar, much like the old film Ice Cold and Alex. There's about 10 people holding their pints, no one speaking, had the first sip. It all came out. Then we got the tube down to Waterloo and we performed, me and Marie performed a gig alongside other people. But it was that sort of extra challenge of, rehearsing for HEMS and then learning for a gig. And we've been doing quite a few open nights since then, up until COVID turned up, which obviously delayed our plans. But yeah, having that release is huge. You go to work, you often see most of the time mundane stuff, mm-hmm. which is a good thing. You don't want to see trauma or medical things that are extremities all the time. But having that creativity of playing music, because I write my own music, write my own songs, record them, or just emulate people just for pure enjoyment. Mm-hmm. And the same for cooking. You know, you're creating dishes that you can both enjoy and other people can enjoy as well. And it's just creating something out of what can sometimes feel like a lot of negativity. You know, people dying, people losing friends, people losing ability mm-hmm. to do their jobs, etc., because of their illness. So being creative for me is a huge release and certainly helps me throughout my career.
Amazing. It's always a pleasure to see you doing all of those things as well. And it's quite incredible, all the plates that you keep spinning. My other question was actually, if you're happy to talk about it as well, was that you mm-hmm. actually had COVID as well, which is obviously your other side of this pandemic. And as a paramedic, finding yourself on the other side of that as well, as a patient.
Indeed.
How are you doing now?
Mm-hmm. I'm doing okay now, back on duty. So I had March 16th, 2020. I was on sort of restricted duty for MRU. I was an acting team, a clinical team manager at the time. And in January, February, I had a very bad chest infection. I nearly ended up in the hospital. The year before, in 2019, I was in the hospital for the first time in my life with asthma and very well looked after by my best mate, who was a consultant on HEMS with me at St Mary's. And I was very fortunate. I took a long time to recover, but I did. I got back on HEMS, fought through. And then in January, I got another chest infection. Very nearly went into hospital again and was very fortunate to fight through it. And then I had two weeks in March where I suddenly thought, I feel okay now. And basically, we're working a lot of projects in the MIU and the CIU, bringing in this Tempest Pro, which is a 12-lead machine that we're bringing in for the first time for MIU and CIU to use. And then we were going to expand the MIU to Hanwell, a station in the west. And on the 16th of March, I was there with my two buddies, and we were drilling holes in the concrete, getting the bay unit set up for the motorbikes. And then the day before that, to be just to state the obvious, I had a huge beard at that time, because that was all the rage that is now. And I thought, as a good governor, I would lead by example, shave it off. So that was the 15th. And then the 16th, we went to Hamwell. And then the 17th, I went to Ilford, the office where the NYU is based. And I'm sitting there with my two colleagues. My boss rings me up. He goes, look, RWS, it's all going a bit bent now. All the service are talking about is isolating people with comorbidities, etc. And seeing as you were in hospital last year, there's no reason why you should stay at work. You're doing restricted duties. You've got your laptop. I want you to go home now, and you can work from home until I tell you to come back. And I thought, okay, yeah, fine. And I had no symptoms. I felt fine. And this was at, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So I got home, 5:30. I made a meal for myself and my wife and the kids. And then all of a sudden I thought, I'm not hungry. Mm-hmm. And my wife was slightly delayed, I don't know, half an hour. And I sat on the sofa and she came in and she goes, are you okay? And I said, I think so. And she goes, you don't look it. And apparently I'd lost my colour. And then half an hour later, that was it. It was incredible. Yeah. It had like a wall of symptoms. And because I have asthma, quite severe asthma. And all of a sudden, I've gone from being able to walk to the train station, go to work, do my duties, to sitting at home, gasping for breath, using my salbutamol, mm-hmm. you know, over and over and over again, just to get my breath. And then I had flu symptoms on top of it. And that developed over 10 days. And I basically gradually got better and then crashed on the 10th day. Ended up having to call 999. I was taken into Northwick Park and spent about 5 hours in resus in Northwick Park, and then spent a week being treated quite aggressively with steroids, antibiotics, magnesium for the etc. And so I was very fortunate. And what was interesting was that the consultant who discharged me said, if this was 5 months ago, he goes, you be here for the next 2 weeks. He goes, unfortunately, we've got people here that are dying. He goes, we don't think you're going to die. You're going to mm-hmm. be okay. But if anything happens, you must come back. So I was released quite early. And so the recovery did take an awful long time. So I've released, mm-hmm. I think it was end of March, beginning of April. And I returned to work about September.
Yeah.
So it took a long time to recover. I still do frontline work. My asthma is a lot more brittle than it used to be, so I tend mm-hmm. to get exacerbations and wheezes a lot more. I've got hip problems because of the inflammation issues, but other than that, I'm just being normal RWS and smiling a lot, just cracking on. And
smiling a lot and not letting that even get in your way.
No, it's not worth it. No, it's not worth it. I'm very fortunate compared to most people, but just keep cracking on, basically.
Well, it's good to see you looking better and being back at work and doing the things that you love as well.
Thank you.
My final question is kind of a wish question. Mm-hmm. If there was one thing that you could change to make your job easier, mm-hmm. what would that be?
Communication. Mm-hmm. It is the be-all and end-all. I mean, it goes from the basic communication of seeing and hearing, or having the ability to hear or see everything. I mean, to a degree, some of the bad things of COVID that have happened have created good opportunities. So whether it's Zoom, whether it's Microsoft Teams, where you've got subtitles, the fact that you can work remotely, the fact that we can have this conversation in different parts of the country, mm-hmm. or even indeed the world if you needed to, is huge, because it's brought people together at times where within an ambulance service, much like a military service, it's so difficult to get 100 people or 20 people across your organisation, different roles, together in one room, in one location. And now we can do that with this stuff. And this is not new technology. This is old stuff, you know. This is stuff that's been going on for about, I don't know, 10, 15 years in the business world. Yeah. And I think that is huge. And also sharing of information. I think the greatest fear that people have is the unknown. It not being told all the information they need to make an informed decision about, okay, I don't agree with it, but I can understand where it's coming from. I can understand the benefits for it, and I can understand the patience we need to do to have to foresee stuff. So it's for me, it's communication. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people's fears in the world, whether it's within a institution or ambulance service or the greater world is assumptions that people make about each other. And therefore, it's like I call it the media. It's probably not the media per se, but it's the fact that people pick up these ideas, not necessarily from their own beliefs, but because the information they're given, whether mm-hmm. it's friends, family, or mm-hmm. the media. And it's the fact that if you're open about stuff and you're prepared to talk, you generally find that when it comes to a really bad day in the office and someone gets run over or stabbed or shot or cardiac arrest, the person that's going to rescue you is probably going to be the most opposite to your beliefs, customs, culture, whatever. And that, at the end of the day, is what humanity is all about. And the world's turned for millions of years or tens of thousands of years, depending on what people's beliefs are. And all the goodness that's come about is normally strangers doing the greater good for, you know, their stranger or their enemy or not even neighbor, you know, just to help people. But communication is definitely the way to break barriers of all sorts, I think.
Great. RWS, I've loved having you on the show. Thank you so much for sharing your stories and for coming to have a chat.
Thank you.
Lastly, if any of our listeners came across you or a paramedic, what mm-hmm. question would you like them to ask you?
Okay. Oh, I'll tell you what, okay, this is quite an obscure one, but probably not so much my hobby. But one question, how to overcome barriers. So for myself, being a deaf person, I never see a barrier as something, as an obstruction to stop me from doing something. The way I see it, it is basically an example or an opportunity for myself or other people with disabilities or any other sort of situation to show other people how to do the same thing in a different way for the greater good of people. So the amount of times I've been told, you can't do this because you're deaf. You can't do this because you can't hear properly. You can't do this for so-and-so. And yet I've served 23 years in the ambulance service, 14 years in the motorcycle response unit, and 4.5 years in HEMS. And yet in all those times, whenever something's come up, I would say I always delivered a solution to the person of interest rather than asking them for a solution. Because as a manager, I myself as a manager now, and I'd appreciate that people will come up to you with 1,000 questions about 1,000 different things, whether it's diversity, whether it's a technical problem, whether it's a medical sort of how does this cell interact with this cell situation. As a manager, you cannot be an expert mm-hmm. in all things. And I recognise that. And if you know your speciality, if you know that you're deaf, if you know that you've got diabetes, if you know it's any other issue, you have an expertise there. So if you can turn around to your manager and say, this is the problem I've got, this, I believe, is a solution working towards it. And that is something I've always strived upon, whether it's developing a hearing module, which I used a few years ago for a radio problem, or different strategies, etc. So it's always a case of providing an answer to your manager how to solve something rather than asking them how to solve it for themselves, because 9 times mm-hmm. out of 10 they will not have a clue, not as a matter of ignorance or a bad feeling, but they have not got your expertise as an individual in your the field you're in. So I think that's sort of the answer.
Also about that real can-do attitude.
Mm.
Brilliant. Well, we're here to provide an authentic voice for uniformed professionals and give our listeners a realistic insight into the jobs we do. And you've done just that tonight. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. It's been a pleasure. So thank you for having me.
Well, that's it for today's episode. We'll be back next week speaking with another uniformed professional about what it's like beneath the blue lights. Thank you for being here, lending your ears to our frontline workers. We're here to shift the conversation, and we can't do that without you. Thank you to Richard Webb Stevens for being our guest today. Remember to follow us on @theparamedicpod on Twitter and @theparamedicpodcast on Instagram. If you found this podcast to be useful and enjoyed listening, please do leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, as it really helps other people like yourself to find the show. Thank you to Pure Creation Media for producing the podcast, and I'll see you next week.